It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. Today's conversation is going to focus on the Festival of Holi. It's a festival of colors, food, spices, vegetables, health and well-being, remembering, and Indian culture. And we have with us today two very special guests, and I want you to welcome now Dr. Jill Patel, who's a neuroscientist and associate scientist at Antigen. Did I get that right, Antigen?
Yep.
Welcome, Jill.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited for this show.
Yes, too. And I have Suman Shah, who's the founder of Fork on a Road in Massachusetts, and she does these wonderful meals and things with vegetables, and we're so excited to have you, Suman.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to be here and chat with both of you and talk about Holi.
Yeah. So why don't we start there? One of you start out, because we probably, few of us really in our listener base, know much about the Festival of Holi. I mean, it was my first experience hearing it from you all. So either one of you could start and let us know a little bit about it.
Jill, do you want to tell us?
I was gonna give it to you, but I will tell you the one like myth that I have most associated with the holiday and the one that I know most about, which is how the festival got its name. And that's the mythological story about Holika. And the story is essentially centers on a evil king, as they describe him, and his name, which somebody can correct me if I'm saying it wrong, but I think it's Hiranyakashyap, right?
Yeah.
So this guy, as I said, evil king, and he wanted to basically be worshipped as a god, and he was able to get most of his kingdom to do that. But he had a son whose name is Prahlad, and he refused to do that. And so he worshiped, you know, God, and did not worship his father in the same sense. And his father essentially went through ways to get rid of him, to kill him. And Indian mythology is very dark. So he found different ways to do it, but his son always managed to escape unharmed. And he finally got his sister, who had gotten, gotten a boon. I don't know what the origin story there is, but she could not be harmed by fire. That was her superpower, essentially. And so he asked his sister to take Prahlad, his son, into this pit or house, I don't remember, and then basically sets it on fire, and Prahlad manages to come out once again unscathed, and the sister is burned to ashes. And the story is essentially the triumph of good versus evil, and that's Holika is where that name comes from. And so it's shortened now to the Festival of Holi.
That's quite a story. And, you know, that's not really, it's not all that unusual. So this was a human king, right? Who tried to make himself a god.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've had people do that all through history. So that isn't a new kind of thing. You're right. But what is really interesting, I think, is the idea of, you know, some of these things come into the present day. Suman, when we think about the festival now, some of these things you do things with food and celebration and color, right, but they're a lot of part of this story.
Yeah, I always, so there are a couple of things that I would like, from my memory, from what I remember, So this evil king, or the king, from what I remember, is that he had sort of, through his own penance and all these things that he did to the gods, he himself had been given certain boons or superpowers. And the myth goes that he could not be slain at, neither dawn or dusk, neither indoors or outdoors, neither by man or, God, and neither in air or on earth or something like that. So there's like this whole thing that he himself had a lot of powers and he could not be touched. And he, of course, wanted his kid to, pray to him, because he had all these supernatural powers. And the child, of course, doesn't, accept that and prays to the true God, or in the sense of in Hinduism, when you think of it, it's Vishnu. And so he only prays to Vishnu. And so this whole sort of myth, but I also look at it as, I'll just add to the rest of the mythological story. It's like Indian gods and demons and everybody have a lot of superpowers. So when I actually watch all the Marvel and DC movies these days, I'm always like trying to think like, oh yeah, of course, one of our gods can do that. And what the other god can do this. And, it's kind of funny. But ultimately the story goes that once the sun escapes the fire unscathed, because his sister has this boon or a blanket that she can wear that protects her from fire. And then somehow during that process, the blanket falls on the child and the son is saved versus the sister gets burned. So that is sort of like that whole, conquest over evil or whatever. But then ultimately the king dies a very gruesome death. And that's when the god takes the avatar of a half human and half lion. And that is the one of the incarnations of God Vishnu. It's called Narsimha. And so this Narsimha god is the one who slays this evil king. And he does it within a doorway. So it's neither inside or outside. He does it at neither at dawn or dusk. So he does it at like a time frame of the day. And then he does it in his lap. So he's neither on ground or in the air. So there was something about like, you cannot be killed by any instrument made by man. And so this god has these nails and he does it with his nails. So it's very gruesome and it's very dark and it's very interesting. As a child, of course, it scares you when you hear these stories. But it's funny because, yes, there's the mythological part of the story where the day before the playing Holi, so there are two parts of Holi. One is in the evening, there's a big bonfire. And, a lot of Hindu communities will sort of get together and they'll make this bonfire and everybody will come to it and sort of pray to the fire. And I just look at it more, I take a step back from the mythology of it and I think of it more as the passing of the seasons, because it's always in March. And I think of it as, the beginning of spring. And it's almost like thinking of it like you're collecting all the dry brush and everything from the winter and you're burning it. So you're preparing, whether it's the ground or the environment or some, for the next season. So it's almost like a cleansing, because fire is cleansing. So I think of it that way. And then also the color component is like just welcoming like that freshness back into your life, because, winter can be long, and especially in the Northern Hemisphere where we all are, it's definitely long and dreary. So I think it's a big invitation for the colors to sort of play a role and like just feel happy.
Yeah, and it also sounds like, it sounds like the story of reincarnation in the terms of you have the death of the plants, they're burned.
Yes.
And they provide nutrients for the new growth of things that would be bright and colorful.
Yeah.
So to me, it just kind of, it sounds like the myth plays out this story of rebirth and beauty, and it's appropriate for spring.
It is. And if you look at some of the plants that are available during that season, actually before synthetic colors and things were made to play holy with, they were using dried flowers and dried plants to play holy with. And that's actually the peak season when those plants are available. So it's kind of interesting to see that's what would have correlated, because they had the, there's a plant called Kesura, or I can't remember. It's like an orange flower, but you get like a pigmented powder from that. And there were different things that you could use to make those natural colors. When I was a kid, we were using synthetic colors. We didn't know any better. What about you, Jill? Did you get to play holy as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I did a little bit. And I remember that the synthetic colors were, I don't know if it had just started, because I back then I didn't know the history behind it. But like you said, a lot of the colors used to be natural and plant-based and relatively safe. And I think when I was playing it as a kid in India, they were mostly synthetic. And you can tell because they're also a lot brighter, like unnaturally bright and like fluorescent. And that's primarily achieved if you're gonna use synthetic chemicals to, you know, make it. And I remember the most like mixing it with water and doing like water balloon fights. But I know that people now also sell like water-based colors, and then there's dry colors, like dry powder, and then there's a paste powder. So there's also different things that they sell right now, but they're all synthetic as far as I know. I know very few places. I don't think I know any places that use the natural colors, because the natural colors will usually stain a lot more easily as far as I can remember. And another like alternative that I tried here in college is they would mix like wheat flour and mix those with a little bit of color. So it gives you the color, but it's not as bright and it's not as intense. So it's dulled, but you still get, you know, if you're looking to just like mess around and throw things around at your friends, that still serves its purpose. But I think in India, the brighter fluorescent dyes or colors are a lot more preferred.
Yeah. So how are they used? I mean, how are the colors used? So I get that there might be synthetic or natural. What are you dyeing?
You are basically throwing it on each other. You're playing with color all day.
Yeah. All day.
And like Jill said, there are wet colors. There are colors that you mix in a bucket of water and then you fill your water pistols with it or your water balloons. And you basically, it's literally like a snowball fight, but with water balloons filled with color. And you make these little forts, or you hide from your cousins, or you surprise your aunts and you throw things at each other. And then if now modern living in India, of course, people are living more in apartments. So I'm assuming that the whole apartment building probably gets in on the play. So, you may not know your neighbor, but you may very liberally douse them with some color.
Yeah, that's the other thing I remember is you could do it. You would go out into like main streets and they would be packed with people. And those are all strangers for the most part. And you can just go up to people and like throw color or water color, whatever. But you could do that with strangers. And so it's like a very communal process of just being out there with everyone else celebrating the same thing. Yeah. And that's exactly how we did it too. It's mostly the water pistols is what we would use. But otherwise you just like pick up a bunch of powder and just like rub it on someone. And we used to wear all white too, so that it's,
yeah.
And I don't know what that's symbolic of or if there's any symbolism behind it, but I think for me, it was just like, you wear something white and you can see the colors better and everyone is kind of like on a same, level playing field. Everyone comes out in white and we're just throwing colors at each other.
Yeah, I mean, we would wear older clothes that you could like part with at the end of the day.
I can only imagine. Or
yeah.
Or if you wanted to keep it as an early tie-dye, I guess it would be hard.
Yeah,
it
was early tie-dye, exactly. And the funny thing was, I remember when I was in middle school that year, somebody had just found out a way to make some silver paint, which was so hard to wash off. And I'm assuming it was completely chemical based. And we would see some cousins with a purple and silver face for days because it wouldn't rub off. Even if you took, like, the mothers would be scrubbing their faces till they were red, but it wouldn't come off. Or the badge of honor would be if your roots right at your, you know, hairline was showing purple for a few days, that meant you really went all out and you played like basically a crazy person.
That was a homemade, these were all
you know, the watercolors. But the my cousins, what they would do is, instead of mixing the whole bag in a bucket of water, which is what the proportion would be, they would take it in their hands, just put a little bit of water and smear it into you concentrated. And so then you would end up with like this purple hairline for a few days. And the nuns at school didn't like it because they were like, you need to clean yourself and come back to school.
Yeah. You need to come back white again. Yes.
Yeah.
The way I understand it then, it would be that you're preparing for this like any other really a big event. So the days leading up to it, then you have the night before is like an eve, right? And that's when the fire, bonfire and all that.
Yeah.
And then when you wake up the next morning.
Oh, it's game on.
It's game on. It also would include foods, right? And so there's a whole celebration. Does it go on and end at that, the evening of that night? So is it like one evening and one day long?
Yeah, I would say that. I don't know, Jill, how you guys did it, but in our case, when we were young, especially, it would, you know, we would go a few days before, probably we would go buy all our color, right? And my parents didn't allow too much of the wet stuff or the chemical stuff. So they would buy us more of the dry powders. And I would have some wet colors, but it was mostly my boy cousins that would have all the gnarly stuff. And I could play with them later. And and we would like have each one of us would have our own little metal bucket of water. And, you know, we'd be like figuring out where we were going to hide or whether we were going to go up to the terrace or not, or to squirt people from above, or would we be on the downstairs level. So there was all this plotting and planning. And so then we'd all play. But then I grew up in a really small town in India, and my sister and her family were, you know, lived across the street, and my aunt was next door. So there were a lot of cousins and friends who we could play with. So we would move from home to home as a group, and we would go terrorize the adults, especially, and, you know, throw things at them, and they wouldn't want to do that. And then I think by the afternoon, it would all peter down where the kids were done, and we would all get our baths by about 3:30. And then we could like go eat, like we would gather at one friend's or family's home, and then we'd eat and celebrate. So everyone probably gets cleaned up by around 3:34, but you have the whole morning to, you know, play.
Have fun.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. It has its origins in the mythology and with certain gods, but I think it's taken on a quality of like our Halloween in a way, where, you know, people get kind of, they do something that's kind of outrageous.
Yes. Right?
And it lasts for a little while. And then, you know, you see the remains of it the next few days on their face and in the sugar content that they have. But that brings me to the idea. So I know food is really important, and particularly in all of India, but in Hindu culture, it's very, very important. And so how it's prepared and what, so can you describe some of the foods that you would prepare for that day?
What do you guys have?
Mine is pretty short because my family we lived in a bigger city, so we had sort of like a multicultural, we celebrated all of the different health festivals, and so it wasn't very, we didn't have like any grand plans, but Holi usually is a time when we would make like very simple but usually very filling dishes. And so my mom would make like the roti or puri, which is the bread, right? And two very simple curries, like potato based or some other vegetable, because we were vegetarians, so I don't have a non-vegetarian view for you. And then for general snacks, which was like a common thing, I think it's common for a lot of festivals in India, that is like the thing you would do multiple days in advance to like prepare for the festival. But we had puffed rice, it's called mamra for me. Mm-hmm. And you just mix that with like a few different spices, and it's roasted, and you eat that as like a light snack throughout the day. And for dessert, I can't remember, I think it's usually I know puran poli is, it's like a sweet stuffed pancake, and the stuffing is sugar based and lentil based, so it's like it's filling but it's not supposed to be too heavy. So I think the overall theme for what we made, and I think what's common, is it's healthy, like filling food, but it's not supposed to be too heavy.
One of my earliest memories of food was definitely a big part of it. And because, like I explained, there were lots of cousins and friends to hang out with, so food was definitely a big deal. And I think Jill is right. Like, I think my mom and probably my aunts and all would probably prepare some homemade snacks in advance so that we would have something maybe, you know, just to like eat as we were playing or if we got hungry in the middle of the day. But the main gathering or the sort of the party part of it, we would always have more sort of like chaat food or street food type of food. And so our family would either do like, they would go all out and like make these things called dahi vadas. Actually, I'm teaching the dahi vadas at next week's class. And those are basically lentil fritters that are then sort of fried, and then they're dunked in a yogurt sauce with a tangy tamarind sauce. So there's all of that. Sometimes we would have like at my sister's, they would do like a big bonfire, and we used to live in the state of Bihar, which is in the northeast, and they would do like very rustic food sometimes if they were not doing chaat, and we would do like these sort of like ball like lentil stuffed things. They're called litti. And they're charcoal grilled. So it's basically a dough that surrounds this lentil stuffing. And then they're all charcoal grilled, and then eggplant and tomatoes and everything is charcoal grilled and mashed to accompany these little balls. And they're eaten with, you know, clarified, like lots of ghee, which is butter. So you would either have that, or if we were ambitious, my grandparents would invite the street food vendors from the actual market into our home. And the entire, like, you know, 12 families would gather, and everybody would just gorge on these three or four vendors who would just set up in our courtyard, and we would just eat our hearts out. So none of the moms would have to cook. So yeah, we definitely ended up having a lot of fun for Holi. And I think the sweets that were prevalent would probably be the jalebi, which is like a funnel cake, right? Which is the fried jalebi, and it's fried dough, basically, like a churro or a funnel cake. And then it's dipped in this saffron and cardamom syrup. And so it's really yummy and it's crispy. So jalebis were probably like the main holiday, the holy sort of dessert that we would eat. The one thing that stands out actually for Holi is a drink called Thandai. And it's made, it's a milk-based drink. And it's made with some spices in it. And the spices mainly are fennel, poppy seed, almonds, saffron, and things like that. And we would, of course, get the non-alcoholic or laced version. But I remember the adult teenage cousins would get into mischief. And they would actually go source cannabis and they would grind that and put it into the thandai. And one year I was allowed to try that. So thandai was a big part of Holi. I don't know why, because I think thandai, to your point, Mark, I think Holi is almost like a festival like St. Patrick's Day and Halloween mashed together. It's like Everything is allowed and high.
That's really great.
That is a great explanation.
It is. We've been talking to Jill Patel and to Suman Shah about the Festival of Holi. And we're going to come back and look at some spices and why spices are so important in Indian food and cooking. And we'll do more of that conversation after this short break.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation about Holi, the spring festival of colors and food and spices and health and well-being, and certainly having a lot of fun. And we've got both Dr. Jill Patel and Suman Shah with us. And when we left, we were just getting to where I was watering in the mouth, and I don't know if any of our listeners were dying to have some of this. But, you know, some of what I was doing, because I know some of these spices, I was smelling, tasting, feeling that virtually, and it was making me so hungry for those. So what is the role of spice in the type of cooking that you're talking about, Suman?
That's a good question, Mark. And I think it plays into the seasonality of what we're talking about, Holi, because Holi primarily is a sort of like a seasonal change festival, right? We are welcoming spring and it's the end of winter. And it's interesting you ask that question, because from a Vedic or an Ayurvedic perspective, spices and food play a big role in what we are consuming in each season. And this transition season is always tricky in the sense that we are going from a part of the season where our bodies are sluggish. We've probably eaten more heavier foods, more warming foods, whether they be in the forms of more fat or more in terms of, I'm a vegetarian, so I can speak to that, but more, grains or pulses that are more heat inducing to your body. And similarly, if you were a meat eater, you probably would be consuming more bigger portions of meat or protein to create that heat and energy in yourself. And as you transition, you need lighter stuff. So I think the spices play a really great role in the transition season, is because in Indian cuisine, you'll start seeing the use of things like cumin and fennel and things that cool and aid digestion as you're going into this new season. There's a spice called ajwain, which is carom seeds. So there's a lot of different things that you can do with them. And one of the drinks that I described was the thandai, which is a milk-based drink. And again, it's a very cooling drink. When you think about the spices that go into it, milk, of course, generates heat, but the drink is served cold, actually. It's a chilled drink. And it has a lot of fennel in it. And it has some black pepper, which aids digestion. And fennel is very cooling to your system. Saffron, again, is cooling and astringent. So there are a lot of different properties there that you're imbibing. And as I was describing earlier, our family would do like a big chaat party, or, you know, we would have a lot of street food kind of foods. And a lot of those foods have a lot of distinct flavors. And I think that plays a role in just waking up your system. So whether it's a tangy sour sauce or a spicy sauce or the cumin, the roasted cumin that you sprinkle on it, or, you know, things that go into it, I think all those play a role in a balance, and the yogurt sauce, of course, to sort of change, you know, get you ready for the change in the season. So that's how I look at food, and how, when you go into one season into another, and how spices play a role in it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to add to that, that a lot of the spices that you mentioned are anti-inflammatory. Like a lot of the spices, most of the, you know, if I look at what their chemical content is always described as anti-inflammatory. And I know that because there are like active ingredients of those spices that people now look at for drug development. And they will, you know, it's not just, there's two parts of it. There's one where you can actually isolate the active ingredients of the spices and figure out that they're having these effects on the body and the brain, since I've studied that. But there's also the effect it probably has as a spice when you add it to food and eat it, because your gut has so many cells and so many, like the whole microbiome is so sensitive and specific. And I bet that depends on the season too, especially when you live in climates where you have the distinctions between seasons. I feel like the food and the spices especially play a role in how you're going to, like how your body itself responds, you know, internally or involuntarily. Because for me, my memories are associated with like summer foods. Like I have mangoes and like things that go with mangoes, spices that go with that, and other fruits that are very specific to the seasons. And I think that has, especially in Indian cuisine, I've noticed it, it's very dependent on where you are. Even like the monsoon season, that's the one that I'm most familiar with, because that's, you know, the changing of the seasons and the monsoons that come in are considered so dirty, or, you know, a dirty time of the month where the environment is so full of bacteria and stuff like that, that I know that they do a fast during that time, which I've done with my mom. We call it Shravan Maino, which Maino means month. And it's essentially a month of you eat only fruits and vegetables, or, you know, no grains, no heavy foods, and it's cleansing your system. And that's like heavily related to how your gut is doing in that time. So it's like there's this very deep connection between the way that the Indian cuisine like schedule is set up throughout the year and how it's all attached to the seasons, the environment, and then that's connected to all these festivals.
No, you're very right about that. And especially the monsoons, when you talk about the monsoons, it's also interesting because I remember our home, we would eat more the vegetables that were more seasonal, and you would definitely not be eating green leafy vegetables because a lot of bacteria travel during the monsoons through the green leafy vegetables because of maybe the conditions they're grown in or the transport or, you know, where they're sold. So because the water, either, you know, the groundwater that they're being, you know, grown in or whatever, it's not clean, or the environment, So yeah, I do. And also they tell you in the monsoons to eat, you know, food that is well prepared. Don't eat anything undercooked and things like that. So it's kind of interesting. And right before we get into the monsoons, also what you talk about the mango season. Mm-hmm. And during the summer in India, the heat is intense. Unless you're sort of in on the coastal areas, then you're getting a lot more humidity with it. But the rest of India is extremely dry heat. And you'll see a lot of use of like sour agents in your food. So whether it be tamarind or garcinia flowers, which is kokum, mangoes, of course, but raw mangoes made into sherbets, lot of lemonade, also sugarcane juice. So there's a lot of like juices that are incorporated in your diets during the heat in the summer months, because I think it helps regulate. You're keeping hydrated, but you're also introducing these sours to probably for your gut bacteria again, and to regulate, you know, what you're consuming, and to be aid the digestion, because there's a lot of use of cumin in the summer as well. Mm-hmm.
What occurs to me is, you know, with our globalism, which has been good, except that we can put, you know, I can go to an Indian restaurant, but now we're not worrying about seasonal. We're worrying about,
exactly,
you know, what sells that day or what's my specialty. And it feels like, and I know in the American diet, we've moved away sometimes from the rhythms. And so our gut bacteria does get really messed up. Because I'm thinking, you guys were talking about in winter months, I would think you'd have a lot of root vegetables and things that are heavier. You'd have a lot of breads,
yeah,
those kinds of things, that, because they're available.
Yeah.
And then you move into the spring, like you were saying, and you're shifting. Yeah. And then in summer, you're shifting. So you're shifting with each of those monsoons. Obviously, you're flooding fields.
Yeah.
The fields are going to take on whatever's in the rivers. And if the rivers aren't in good shape, it's bad news. So you don't have it. I think this whole thing on gut bacteria and your biome, people had it right, even though it may have been somewhat based in the mythology, right? But yeah, it was, mm-hmm, but that helped guide, yeah, healthy eating.
Right.
Yeah. And I like that people are actually committing to understanding how the gut microbiome actually operates, and, you know, the connections to your brain and also to your other organs, because it regulates essentially everything. But it's always been obvious to me because of, you know, the culture and the household I grew up in, that there are certain things you eat at certain times and it makes sense and all of that. And there is never like a scientific way to explain it because there's not that much research out there. It's only now starting the whole like gut brain axis is only now being looked at more. And it's relevant because people have found out that it affects your brain function and it like leads to mental illnesses and stuff like that. And so it's obvious that you would want to study it. But I think it's important, even if you wanted to regulate, like it's not just something you have to look at if you have something, like if something's wrong with you. But for me, it's always been like proactively, that's the one way, probably the most simplest way to regulate your entire body and take care of it. Like, and it has so much to do with, I think, the seasons, because I just realized this, but I've only done the fast that I talked about, like around the monsoon season, once in the actual month it was supposed to be done here, like in the United States. And I remember my body felt a lot better, but also like my thought processes and like my brain function was very clear, like clearer than it had been in a while. And I've tried it again in different seasons and it hasn't worked the exact same way. I'm just like one person, so I don't know what that means, but I think it's interesting that the seasons might actually have something to do in addition to you just taking care of your body, because you mentioned, you know, you can go anywhere now and find avocados or strawberries when they're not like in season, but it's like, should you eat them? I mean, they're healthy for you, so you can, but that's a very interesting like question for myself that I haven't really figured out.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Jill, because and just to like when I create, so just briefly, it's like when I'm creating recipes for my meal kits, what I'm trying also to encourage people is to eat those flavors. So I have something with fennel and basil in it, or I have something with, you know, mint and spinach in it. So you're focusing on what's going to grow now as we go into the the early summer produce, right? It's more of the green leafy stuff that starts coming in initially. And people don't think about it. And you're right, Mark, like, honestly, the last 3 or 4 years since I've been working closely with the farmers markets and the seasons and developing these recipes and things like that, I'm extremely mindful about what I buy at the grocery store in the winter when I'm not able to access my farmers markets. And we've been eating pretty much seasonally. I try not to buy berries and I try not to, like, I actually avoid those, but then I will buy citrus because it is local enough to the US and it is seasonal enough for us over here. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, just trying to find out what is growing around us during that period. And just to what Jill said, like coming back to that question, like, yes, I know blueberries are good for me, but should I be eating them in the middle of January in New England? You know,
When they're not from there.
Right. And they're coming from, you know, Chile or wherever right. It is that they're growing at that point in time.
Right. And so, that would be in their, you know, their local cycle and their biome would match. Exactly. Jill, I'm curious, I know you that as part of the work that you've done, there's also been, there's more and more about how the gut actually does communicate. You started to say a little bit of that, but our scientists seem to be figuring out that there's actually a communication between the gut and the brain and almost a dialogue that happens.
Yeah, there's, I don't know how, when it first started, honestly, but it's been fairly recent because it wasn't very common, you know, for someone to say, well, how is eating something or how does the diet change your brain behavior? And it's kind of obvious, but it's only being fully studied now because the gut, I mean, in addition to you have bacteria, you have viruses, you have, you know, other fungal microorganisms, and there is tons of that in your gut. And I feel like people know about the bacteria, obviously, because that's the most talked about. But there's also a subset of neurons in your gut. And so they're referred to as the enteric, they're the subset of neurons and a few other cells that communicate with the brain and the other organs are called together the enteric nervous system. So it's like your second brain in your body. And your gut actually produces the majority of the serotonin in your body. And that's the mood regulator neurotransmitter, which if you follow any like neuropsychiatric illnesses, that's one of the major dysregulation of that neurotransmitter in your body is one of the major problems that lead to depression and anxiety and several other disorders. So it's clearly, that's why I mentioned it. It's not just that there's research now showing the connection, but it leads to this idea that what you eat matters for your brain health. And it matters for not just, you know, how quickly your memory is able to function, but it's also responsible for your moods and your anxiety and your stress levels and things like that. So it's possibly answering the question of, can you eat things to regulate some of the problems you might have?
Yeah, so that, you know, that role of nutrition, wow. And, you know, I'm someone that sometimes suffers like other people do from anxiety for certain moments. And I can go the other way. I can affect my neurons in my gut in a negative way from my brain, just my brain being so scared. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the idea that maybe I could do something there with the gut that would regulate my brain, that would be an awesome thing. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore this intersection between art and science. And we encourage you to do that with each other and explore some of the topics that we have today. Look at websites, which we'll let you know here in a minute. Suman has a wonderful website with recipes, and we'll be right back.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about the Festival of Holi, and we've extended ourselves way beyond that into the brain and our gut bacteria. And I was curious, before we left, Suman, would you tell us where we can go, what your website is, and what kinds of things we might find on there?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I started the company Fork on a Road about 3 or 4 years ago. And that is the name of the website as well. It is Fork on a Road. I know a lot of people, the phrase is Fork on the Road, so they confuse that. I purposely picked it as a road because it was my road, my path in my life. And I started the company after spending almost, 20 years in the digital publishing media business. And it was actually a comeback to what we were talking about. As my parents were going through their last stages of life, we spent a lot of time focused on going back to the roots of like how and what we were eating or feeding them necessarily, and how we were getting most nutrition and bang for the buck for them. Because as you age and as you're going through, you know, your end of life stages, you're not consuming as much food. So that really was sort of the hyper-focus period that sort of shifted things for me. And at the same time, I started developing recipes and doing chop style demonstrations at farmers markets. I approached a local market and, just honed in on all of that sort of topic that we talked about, is like, are we eating seasonally? What is it that we are eating? What's growing around us? What is it at its prime, and how are we using it? And how do we enhance it with spices? So I started doing that. And from that, the business was born. Customers asked to eat like I was eating or what I was making. And so I create recipes that are for meal kits. And I want people to buy and curate their own vegetables, because a lot of my customers are already buying CSAs, or they're growing their own, or, you know, whatever. And so I provide the dry ingredients in the meal kits with specially blended spices that I make myself. And I also create spice blends on the side as well that you can just buy and experiment with. But the main goal is to just bring mindfulness to your plate and to that moment of when you're cooking, like, what am I making and what's going into it and where did I get it from and who grew it? So I know that that is all sort of also having its moment, and it's maybe in the, you know, people's consciousness, like the whole sustainability thing. But I think that's how our ancestors lived. And I think there's a big calling that I have is to, like, how do we get back to that? And how do we get back to what Jill was saying, like really understanding what we are feeding ourselves and what our gut is saying to our nervous system, and how we're impacting everything just based on what's on your plate. So I think that sort of sums up what I do for Fork on a Road.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, and recently you've started doing even some online classes, which are wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I've attended some of your classes and they're really fantastic, because I do think two things are going on that you mentioned. One is that we've lost the ability to think about spices. We use a certain set that we're comfortable with.
Yeah.
But we forgot about other spices that we could use that do different things. I think of spice wheels that people have sometimes that help us kind of round out our spice, you know, selection. That brings me to this other thought. I know that in a lot of Indian cooking, that it there that if you are a regular household cook, you have a tin that in it has your spices, right? I mean, your things. Can you describe, both of you describe a little bit about how important that is, that have to have that tin? And I would assume it shifts with what, with maybe season or whatever. Maybe.
Go ahead. Tell us what your mom has.
Okay. Well, yeah, because I don't think we switch the spices, which now after this conversation I might have to consider doing, because we have a whole cabinet of it, but our spice box has red chili pepper, cumin coriander powder, turmeric powder, and cumin seeds. Mustard seeds. Yes. I was like, I can't forget this. Ajwain, which someone mentioned, the karam seeds, and cloves. And so that's like, I think I use almost all of those except for the karam seeds in almost everything that we cook. And we usually do Gujarati, which is the, Gujarat is the state in Western India. And that's, those are the most commonly used spices in almost every dish. And then you would just kind of add from your spice cabinet.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like my baseline is also sort of like a Gujarati-ish dabba or box. Mm-hmm. And it has all the things that Jill mentioned, but then I also have a second one. And then there are lots of jars. but the second one has a lot of my sort of Northeast India sort of influenced flavors in there. We use a lot of like fennel, fenugreek, nigella seeds, whole coriander. And my mom was from the South. So I have a couple of lentils that we use in stir frying as well. So I have some urud dal, which is like a gram dal in there. Whole peppercorns, which is a very South Indian thing to do. So that's my sort of my second tier box that's always handy. And there's always like dried chilies, dried curry leaves or fresh curry leaves. Oh my God. Yeah, there's a plethora of things.
Wow, you have two boxes. That's like next level.
Yeah. I love this idea of levels of boxes. And you know, as a cook that I've been cooking for so long, I do it differently, but I wish I had, I want to adopt this too, because, you know, I'll put them in little glass containers, you know, little bits of my spices that I'm going to cook with for that evening, and I have them out. There is something though, I think also magically and artistic about the box and the colors, the smells, all that. I think that that adds to more than just the function of cooking. And I don't know. I mean, I think everybody should go get a spice box. Is there, are there recommendations for what should be, if people were going to want to start a spice box, what they should start with?
What they should put in it?
Yeah. What should they do?
Someone, what do you suggest?
I was just going to say, I think a basic spice box, depending on what kind of cuisine, even from within India, you want to make, I think that's your starting point. Okay. So if you're attracted to more sort of Punjabi or North Indian food, then your spice box would have a few different ingredients than the Gujarati style that what Jill and I mentioned. But the baseline would always have turmeric, red chili powder, cumin. And then of course you could add, you know, your whole cloves, whole cinnamon sticks, cardamom for sure, if you like more Punjabi food. So that would definitely, you know, gear more towards the warmer spices, which is what are also the basis of a lot of the garam masala that we make and sell with Curio Spice. So it depends on that. And then if you were more in the western part of India, whether it was Rajasthan, Gujarat, and Maharashtra, you would have more of the box that we described, where there's cumin, mustard seeds, turmeric, chili powder, and asafoetida for sure, which is hing.
I really like this idea. Then rather than having a bunch of, you know, I will always have a bunch of spices, but then I get lost in them, and then I find out how old they are some days. But this idea by cuisine. So you went Eastern and Western India.
Right.
But I could imagine a Spanish box from Spain, one from Mexico. Absolutely. That has my go-to things for that. And then I'm not trying to find them all.
Yeah.
And they stay fairly fresh the way that, I mean, as well as anywhere else. Because the spice box seals and it's really neat. So I think you have a new business.
I was just going to say, you
spice
just
boxes of the world.
Hopefully by the time, maybe this Christmas or next Christmas, maybe we'll have some inspired
that's
boxes.
That's right. I think that is one other thing, just circles us back, but this idea of color, color is just absolutely so important. I mean, we think of spices as adding flavor and smell, but often they add color. And color is something so important in our cooking. I remember a time when my mother was in a nursing home and it was all gray, because everything had to be, and I was thinking, you don't have to have it be that way.
No, you don't.
That is really bad cooking, because who would want to eat all gray food all the time? And so it is, you can make it without being spicy, but what I mean is you can add color to
Absolutely. And coming back to Holi and color, I was reading an article and I sent you a link, I think, for that, is that in the past, natural colors were made from plants and vegetables and, turmeric is the yellow, and beetroot made the purple or the red. And so natural foods were used to make the colors for Holi. And like you said, color means a fresh start. It's a new growing season. It's spring again, and you're going to, start planting new things. And it's just such a big cycle. And it is about celebrating that.
This has been really great having this conversation. It makes me think that we need to have our own special Holi festival at the end of COVID worldwide.
Oh my God, yes.
Where we just go spray everybody with color.
It's like a block party. Everyone's invited.
Like a giant worldwide block party. It would be awesome. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Jill Patel and Suman Shah, for helping us explore this incredible festival, but also, the neuroscience and brain and body connection and food. And I am so hungry. I'm ready to go try to make something from this. But I want to remind people that you can find out some links to Suman's website and some information about both of our guests on our website at thedaVinciPursuit.com. And we are excited to have you join us again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of science and art.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.